Okay, at this point I can now start this morning's talk. And there's one simile which I enjoy bringing up about this time of the meditation retreat, just to give an idea of an overview of what meditation is and how it works. At the same time, giving you an indication of the different stages of meditation, how they occur naturally. I know that many people have heard this before, but it's a simile of the thousand-petaled lotus. And I tell this simile because, for several reasons, one, to show that everybody has the ability, the opportunity to go very deep in meditation, and also that everybody just has this incredible beauty inside. And sometimes the people I least expect are the ones who open the lotus so far. And what they find inside is not only just joyful, but full of great understanding and of Dharma, of insight. And even more importantly, it encapsulates in this simile just the way of meditation. Now, you're part in it, if you like, and how it unfolds. And that simile is of a lotus, which is a great simile in Buddhism. It has many, many different usages in Buddhism. And the one I'm going to be talking about is how it opens up. But before I go there, in case people feel that that might be too much for them, the other simile of a lotus is that a lotus never keeps anything. That you can urinate on a lotus, and the urine, smelly and stinky as it may be, just falls off the lotus petals. And afterwards you pick up that lotus and it smells like a lotus, not like a urinal. Or if you pour Chanel No. 5 over the lotus, please excuse me, but I don't know perfumes anymore. Maybe 45 years ago, when he used to go out with girls. But that's a long time ago. But apparently Chanel No. 5 is still popular, so I've been told. But anyway, that if you pour Chanel No. 5 or some expensive perfume over the lotus, that too drips off. And the lotus doesn't keep the smell. It has its own smell, its own fragrance. So a lotus has its own fragrance, no matter whether the most disgusting things or the most delightful things are poured over it. And to me that was a wonderful simile for praise and blame. If somebody praises you and says, what a wonderful meditator, what a wonderful monk, what a wonderful nun, what a wonderful person they are, that's like pouring Chanel No. 5 over you. It drips off. And if they urinate all over you, in other words, they criticize you and they tell you off and they say what a terrible person you are. That too should just drip off. So you remain as you were before, a pure, fragrant lotus, not really moved by the praise and blame of the world, which is sometimes well-placed and sometimes misplaced. I know that I've been praised for many things I didn't do. And I've been blamed for many things I didn't do as well. So I think it's fair. It types of balances out. But anyway, going back to the simile of the thousand-petal lotus, which is more about meditation. Lotus flower closes up at night time. And if you see the closed bud of a lotus, you look at it, examine it, and it's rough, it's serrated. It hasn't got much colour in it, and it's probably dusty as well. And certainly it hasn't got any fragrance there, it's rough. Because the outermost petals, they have to be thick, and they have to do that to withstand the heat, the warmth, the weather, and everything else which the weather and life throws at it. It's rugged, you might call it weather-worn. But as you know, inside that lotus is this most beautiful, fragrant petals. And the deeper you go, the more beautiful and fragrant those petals are. And they only open up because of the warmth and light of the sun. When the sun rises in the morning, then it heats up the outermost petals, the sheath, if you like, and it slowly opens to reveal the first layer of petals inside, which have got color and a tiny bit of fragrance, but even those have to be quite thick. For that allows the warmth and light of the sun to reach the first real layer of petals rather than the sheath. So they too can open up. And that allows the warmth and the light of the sun to hit the second layer of petals. And as they open up, the third layer, as they open up, the fourth layer, layer by layer, the petals open up, revealing something inside which is more beautiful, more fragrant, and more delicate. As you go deeper and deeper into the petals, always opening up for the same causes, warmth and light, you get deep, deep, deep into the heart of the lotus. And of course, that lotus stands for you. That lotus stands for a human being who might look very, very rough on the outside. And the story which I tell to illustrate this was of this gentleman who came on a retreat here a couple of years ago. This was the biggest surprise for me. And it was because of my stupidity and because I judged a person far too rashly just on their appearance. And you never judge a person on their appearances, obviously, but sometimes we make those mistakes. So this gentleman came in to this retreat center. I was on one of the retreats I was conducting, and I was happened to be around the office. And when this gentleman came in, that he was tall, maybe young, about 25, full of tattoos, with, I think, some jeans on and a singlet, and he looked so rough-looking that I thought, you know, he's made a mistake. And I said, excuse me, but this is a Buddhist meditation center. We're about to start a retreat. If you want to visit the prison farm up the road to see your friends, it's only... Sometimes I can be so stupid. And he looked at me and said, no, I'm booked on this retreat. And he was the last person I'd ever expect to actually be booked on a retreat. That's how I was stereotyping him. But, and I mentioned that because, yeah, his name was on. It's okay, well, sorry, I apologize. You're welcome. But even though he looked on the outside very rough, and I hadn't seen him before, that when he came to the interviews one day, he was the one who, as he described his meditation experiences, was, wow, that was a real jhana, classical jhana, and he'd had that. And that just really put me in my place twice. First I thought, no, he didn't really belong here, but he exceeded everybody else in his depth of meditation experience. And that just reminded me that it doesn't matter just what you look like, and it actually doesn't matter if your past experience even. Because everyone has got these beautiful lotuses and beautiful layers of petals deep inside, no matter who you were, where you came from, what you've done. Because we can all let go of our past if we have the courage and the inspiration. We could all just go very deep inside if we follow this wonderful process of kindness and mindfulness. And you're amazed at what happens. And sometimes that people are meditating and they think, what? You know, afterwards, me as well, that I can get into these deep meditations? Wow, I never thought that was possible. And to say it is possible for every person who meditates. And the simile of the lotus makes that quite plain. mindfulness and kindness. That is the warmth. The warmth is obviously the kindness, and the mindfulness is the light. You need both to open a lotus. Just the light is not enough, you need the warmth as well. And that's the same with you, to open you up, to go deep inside, the warmth and the light, the kindness, compassion, and also the awareness. You may try using force and just peeling those leaves off through the force of your, you know, your hands, but that doesn't sort of work, that destroys the lotus. To let it open up naturally is just a beautiful experience. And you also have to have lots of patience, because you can't give a schedule to a lotus when it has to open up by. It does it according to its own cause and effect at its own rate. So, you are your lotus. Rough on the outside, sometimes you feel you're hopeless, there's no way you can do this. Well, all you need is to maintain the kindness, the warmth, the opening the door of your heart to this moment, the awareness. Those two together are extremely powerful. And of course, I've already mentioned in some ways how this works. You start by being kind to your body, being aware of what it needs. And so, you know, you eat enough, not too much, not too little. You come into a nice room and just sit down comfortably. On a chair is fine, on the cushions are fine. And I've often mentioned this, I'm really surprised that no one's opened up a business for high-tech meditation cushions. These Zafus are just so old-fashioned. Why can't we have, like we have in modern worlds, high-tech cushions, so they have different compartments to them. And if, you know, your butt needs to be raised a bit, you press the little remote control and you feel it rising up. If your right leg needs to be raised a bit because it's hurting, you know, you can have another button that rises up. If it's a bit sore, you press another button, it can massage your butt. If you're too hot, you can have little jets of air coming up the side, cool you down. If you're cold, warm you up. I've been in even like people get their cars from Japan or somewhere, and you press a button and it warms the car bottom for you. And so, and not only that, if you really have sloth and torpor during the meditation, and you got up a bit too early and you're nodding, you press another button and you get a nice cup of coffee. You have a latte. Just press a button. High tech. I'm sure there'll be a market for that somewhere. So high tech meditation cushions. And also, I have a control also. So if I see that, you know, that you are getting too tired, and I can actually play, and you get a very compassionate electric shock to wake you up. It's much better than the old Zen sticks they used to use in the old days. They know, you know, they can't use Zen sticks anymore. That was, somebody was talking about Buddhism in mainland China. And this story, because I go to Hong Kong, and meeting with a few other monks over there, just like everybody else, having a cup of coffee in the afternoon, or a cup of tea, sorry, and we were gossiping. You know, what's it like in Australia? What's it like in Hong Kong? What's it like in Taiwan? What's it like in mainland China? And, you know, latest news. And this monk told me there was a meditation retreat. This must have been only about 6 or 7 years ago, run by a Zen master, and in some mainland China somewhere. And in that retreat, they had the Zen stick. So anybody who's a little bit sort of noddy, they get whacked on the back with the Zen stick. And what happened was the master was walking down the line, saw this middle-aged lady, and she was nodding, whacked on the back with the Zen stick. And she didn't like that at all. She got out her cell phone, called the police, charged him for assault, and the police came and took him away. That was the end of that retreat. And it happened. So So that's one of the reasons why we don't allow cell phones in this retreat. In case I said something wrong and you called the police and took me away. Anyway, of course you don't want to do stuff like that, and everybody has to learn just, you know, why you get sleepy. All of that sloth and torpor business. That for years and years and years, the tiredness, I was always really struggling with the sloth and torpor when I was in Thailand. And I try everything, you know, to try and overcome the sloth and torpor. Use your willpower, use your force, use the, you know, you all know that story. Maybe you don't, so I'm going to do it again anyway. What we tried was using the matchbox tray trick. We didn't have many things in that monastery, but we could have a matchbox. Takes the cover off it, just have the tray, and you'd put it on your head as you're meditating. Because if you got sleepy, it would fall. It'd give you feedback. You knew that you were nodding. It's one of the problems with, if you are sleepy, you don't know you're sleepy. That's what sloth and torpor is. It dulls your mindfulness, so you don't know what's going on. But when that fell, you knew, oh, I must have been nodding. So, you put that on your head, and you use that as your feedback to try and make sure that that never fell off. And after a week, I got there. The matchbox would never fall off my head. I could sit there for an hour, and the matchbox never fell. I thought, I've conquered my sloth and torpor. Until one of the other monks took me aside and said, I found out why that matchbox never falls anymore. You're still nodding, Ajahn Brahm, but in a different way. You're nodding like this. That's why your body and psychology is really mean sometimes. It's so tricky. So that never worked. But what happened was that one day, I went down to Bangkok to renew my visa. And there was a new building which had opened up in one of the main monasteries in Bangkok. It was a royal monastery called Wat Bawon. Very wealthy monasteries where kings of Thailand get ordained. And they had a new building there. And it had nice rooms, nice food, and a good rest, no mosquitoes to keep you awake at night, no tarantulas, because in those forest monasteries, sometimes it was so hot, you took off your upper robe, so you're bare-chested, and when you lay down to take a rest, the tarantulas would fall from the ceiling right on your bare chest. But was I scared? Actually, I looked forward to that, because you know, you don't have much sensory pleasure as a monk in Thailand. But they would crawl all over your skin. And it was actually tickly. It was quite nice. So I didn't mind the tarantulas falling on me. Come on, guys. They never bit or done anything wrong. It was just tickly, that's all. But anyway, in this monastery, they didn't have tarantulas in the middle of Bangkok. So I had a good night's sleep, and in the morning, to meditate, we found that they had an air-conditioned room, which they were using to give lectures during the day. And no one was using it at 3:30 in the morning, except we forest monks. So we asked, can we have the key, can we use it in the morning for a couple of hours meditating before we go on arms round? And it was amazing. He had good food, nice and cool, and at last, no sloth and torpor at all. It was so easy to meditate and get nice and deep. And I started thinking that all this sloth and torpor, a lot of it is just cause and effect. It's not a personal failing which you have to sort of push use your willpower to push through. A lot of it was just, look, I was born in England, you know, and this was not my climate in Thailand. And it was malnourished in those days. I'm making up for it now. But I was really thin. And not only that, Ajahn Chah kept on telling us you should only sleep 4 hours a day, total. And I could never get, I'd get down to 4.5, and that's about as close as I could get. But that was not enough for a young man. So I was tired, sleep deprived, malnourished, and in a climate which I wasn't used to. You chase a couple of those causes, a nice cool room, good food, bit of nutrition in it, good night's sleep, and then meditation was no problem at all. Really peaceful. And from that time on, I realized that if you really need to get some good meditation, look after your body. Be kind to it. This is not a boot camp for US Marines. That's why we don't call it a concentration camp. Which is, if you think meditation is concentration, that's what it becomes like. And if you are kind to your body, then your mindfulness can actually do its job as well. And you can get quite peaceful and deep in your meditation. It is called middle way. So if you are sleepy, it's probably you haven't slept well last night, or you know, you're just the room is too hot or too cold for you, just find a nice place in this compound where it's your right temperature for you. Even just taking a cushion and meditating in your bathroom. Actually, don't call it a bathroom. I prefer the American term, restroom. Isn't it nice calling it a restroom? So if it's a restroom, we'll take a rest there. It's cooler because of the tiles. But whatever, wherever you find it nice and comfortable for you, that's where you should meditate. You find it's much more conducive. So, using the kindness and the mindfulness of your body, you know exactly what you need. Whether you do need a chair, or you do need sort of a cushion, or you don't need the cushions at all, or you need a quieter place, or a cooler place, or a warmer place, and find that out. That is basically mindfulness and kindness. To me, that one of the, yeah, you should be mindful, you should let go, but the question always is, how do you become mindful? How do you let go? One of the greatest ways of being mindful, as I pointed out already, ask a question of your body. Head, how do you feel? Then you're mindful of your head. And listen to your head. What does it need? Your butt. Ask your butt, how are you down there? Anything I can do for you? The mindfulness comes when you ask questions. It's directing your attention at important parts in your body. But just being mindful is not enough. Once you get the information, you've got to do something about it. Which is where I come to the story of the wealthy, I always used to say wealthy woman, I'll do a wealthy man. A wealthy man leaves his mansion one evening to go and listen to a Buddhist talk. And the wealthy man tells the gatekeeper of the mansion to be mindful because there are many thieves in the neighborhood. There are burglars, and they target wealthy mansions, especially when they know the owner is out. So she tells, be especially aware and mindful tonight, gatekeeper. I'm going to the temple, I don't want to be robbed. And when she comes back from the temple, she finds that her mansion has been robbed and ransacked. So she goes up to her guard and said, I told you to be mindful. Why is my mansion being ransacked? And he said, what do you mean? I was mindful, madam. What do you mean you were mindful? Well, I saw the thieves going in, and I noted, thief going in, thief going in, thief going in. I saw them carrying all your jewelry out, and I noted, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them backing in up their truck to the front, truck going in, I saw the safe going out, safe going out, say, I was mindful all the time, madam. That is not trying to put one over on Vipassana traditions, but what it really means is that mindfulness is not enough. Mindfulness has some responsibilities to it, some duties. So the mindfulness, if you see, you know, the burglars going in, just ring up the police. Make a noise. Do something. That's your responsibility. To be kind to the burglars so the burglars don't make bad karma. And being kind to your job so you have the job the next day. Being kind to the person who employs you so that, you know, she or he doesn't have to, you know, worry about what to do next. It's just simple common sense. But sometimes people think, well, just be mindful. Sometimes think, well, oh, I know, if this is just karma or something. Yeah, so you fall over, you break your leg. If I fell over and broke my leg, I wouldn't sit here and say, oh, it's just my karma. I've got to wear out my karma. And just, I can't interfere with my karma. Of course you'd call the ambulance and get the break healed up. You don't just do nothing. You've got responsibilities there. Sometimes when I teach, people think, oh, just Ajahn Brahm, you only tell us to let go. No. There's times to let go, and there's times to call the ambulance. So, if to make it quite clear, there's a few Sri Lankans here. If you are traveling down the Gaul Road on the back of a motorbike, don't let go. Attach with everything you've got. Grasp, cling on for your life. The Gaul Road is a particularly busy road in Colombo. But anyway, that you do need that kindness as well. So when you have the mindfulness and kindness, your body relaxes. It's wonderful to feel that body relaxing, mindful and kind to the body. Is that okay? That's okay. Get myself a nice position. Then that outer sheath of the lotus, the body, opens up. And you get to your inner world, your mind. And that inner world, the mind, yeah, it can be sort of very disturbed at first. That's why the peaceometer, just to calm it down. And a lot of times, the first thing which disturbs the mind, even before thinking, is past and future. You know, we're so obsessed with what happened in the beforehand. We're so really afraid what might happen in the future. And so we have to go in the center of that. Allow the past and future, the petals of time, to open up, to go inside the present moment. Such a nice thing, the present moment. So, but you're going inside of time. And it's strange that sometimes people are so obsessed with time that they wonder how many minutes they meditate, how many hours they meditate, and they decide that coming on this retreat to try and improve their personal best, their PB, they only usually do a half an hour meditation. They're going to go for 35 minutes this time. I'm going to improve my PB. That's just so much. Okay, here comes this word now. Go, my young. If you don't know the word go, my young, it's a Pali word. You actually won't find it in the suttas. I made it up. But go, G-O, is a Pali word for the male, the bull, B-U-L-L. And Mayang means the stuff, the stinky stuff, which comes out of the backside of the bull, S-H-I-T. So people, you know, get a bit upset when I say bullshit. Oops. So instead, I say, go, Mayang. So where I say, say, go, Mayang, then you know what that means. So anyway, just worrying about how long you sit is a lot of go, Mayang. Instead, the quality of this moment, being in this moment, timeless. Because when you have no perception of the future, no perception of the past, then time as you know it doesn't exist. The time as you know it is all a measurement. between the past and the present, the past and the future, or the present and the future. It's a measurement. When you don't measure because you've got nothing to measure to, or nothing to link back on, you can't measure anymore. You're just here. And whether it's good or bad, it is literally, who knows, because you've got nothing to compare it with. And if you can just get into this present moment, whoa, most of your craving and wanting is gone. Because, you know, all you're wanting is where you want to be in the future. And if you haven't got a future to look at, all that wanting has got no place to land, no place to roost, no place where it can aim for. It's like shooting an arrow into the sky. It's got no target. And the same with the past. You can let the past go in the present moment. There's no way the baggage from the past can even reach you. You're like a person, you might get a summons from something you did in the past, but you've got no address. You can't get to you in the present moment. The past is out of reach. So anyway, because of that, just go into this mind, into the present moment. And that's what it feels like, you're in here, just being here. Nothing to judge yourself by. Nothing to say just how far you've come or how far you've gone. Because the back of the path is invisible. Or the future of the path you can't see. So I said to someone earlier, just like the wind. The wind, you only know the wind when it meets your face. And you can feel the cold or the hot or the stimulation of the air brushing past your skin. Where that wind came from, you can never find. Where that wind will go to, you will never know. You can only be sure and know the wind as it's passing your face right now in the present moment. Let's just like this present moment. It's very beautiful and peaceful. And as you open up into the present moment, it's almost simultaneously you're in the silence of the mind. You can't think. There's nothing much to say about the present moment. Just here. So little by little, you open up the lotus and just go into present moment awareness and silence. That was one of the definitions I made of mindfulness. Because you really are here, you're aware. If you try and describe it, take notes, it's what's happened a few moments ago. You're describing the past. And you know that all your descriptions, all your thinking is always biased and bent. Depending on, I said this to a dharma at a house I went to the other day, that if Sri Lanka is playing Australia in the cricket match, then the commentary by a Sri Lankan commentator is very different than the commentary from an Australian commentator. They're seeing the same match, but for the Sri Lankan, that was LBW. Certain. You're saying, no, it was missing the wicket. If you know cricket, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what cricket, you probably think this is... But anyway, I always remember that's this great definition of cricket. Cricket is a game the English invented because they weren't a very spiritual people and they needed to have some sense of eternity. It goes on and on and on. A really cool quote. Anyway, that you're biased with our commentary. Always will be. So when you stop that commentary, you can see things without, a lot of times, without sort of biasing it, and it's much more peaceful. That story, it would go too long, that story of Lao Tzu, say it very quickly, it's in the book and I said it many times, going for a walk with his disciple, had to keep absolute noble silence, you weren't allowed to speak. When he saw a beautiful sunset, the student was so excited by the beauty of the sunset, He just forgot the rule and said, "Wow, look at that beautiful sunset." Lao Tzu turned around, went back to the temple, and after he returned to the temple, Lao Tzu said, "Never again can you go on a walk with me." "Oh, you're being too tough, too hard. Anyway, what's wrong with saying, 'What a beautiful sunset'?" And that's the whole point of the story, the thing which really struck me and which I kept in my mind and used as a teaching story, was that Lao Tzu replied, "When the student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words." So, wow, that was a wonderful way of pointing out the difference between the commentary and the experience. You're not watching the sunset anymore. If you say, "What a beautiful sunset," you're watching the words. There's a huge difference there. So when you get into the silence, you're not making a commentary about your experience. You're just being here. And I know there's a few people who have come here for the first time. So this is another of the standard exercises. And please share this with others. It's such a simple exercise and it usually always works. Usually always works. Well, it always does work. As I'm speaking, be aware of your reaction inside your mind. Because as I am speaking, you'll begin to notice something very weird and strange. As I am speaking, you will begin to notice some spaces between my words. In those gaps, between my speech, what was happening in your mind? You were silent. You weren't thinking. How easy is it to experience a silent mind? And it's really cool, it's beautiful, it's wonderful to actually to experience what we mean by silence. So this is just pointing out what we mean by the silent mind. Present moment, silence. The reason it works is because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. So you're waiting, pausing. There it was again. If I pause too long, then you start thinking, the thoughts will start to come in and disturb the experience. But at least the silence, the peace is great. So you're opening up your lotus, going up into inner silence. Just knowing, without giving anything a name. So, what happens next? Inside the silence, the lotus opens up. What do you do to open it up? Just mindful and kindness. It's all the time, mindful and kind. In the moment, mindful, kind. It opens up into the breath. Weird. It's the other reason why I sometimes wonder, why is the breath the most common meditation object? Because it's natural, it happens anyway. And the reason is that when you are getting peace, you've got nothing to think about, that it's the only thing moving. In one of those Zen monasteries I went to as a young man, in those days, I go to any temple, any monastery, holding a retreat, I didn't care what tradition, because I didn't have any choice. So I went to this Zen monastery for the weekend, and then when I was there, I didn't know what the heck I was supposed to do. That's why people say, "Ajahn Brahm, can't you teach us how to meditate?" I said, "No, that will spoil it for you." because this was my experience. I didn't know how to do Zen meditation. All I was told to do is sit on the bench and just watch the wall, eyes open. Haven't done that before. So there I was, sitting down there, just looking at this whitewashed wall. That was it. That's my instructions. I didn't know what to do, so yeah, we didn't try anything. So I was watching that whitewashed wall. But I did, had learned some Theravada meditation before, so I knew how to be in the present moment and just to be quiet, to be silent. And then, after about half an hour, 45 minutes, I can't remember exactly, the wall disappeared. It vanished. It was gone. There before, not there anymore. Wow, that was weird. Some people would run away and go and see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Is something wrong with them? This is not supposed to happen. Walls aren't supposed to disappear. But I had enough sort of, because weird things, this was in the late 60s, 70s, so anything weird was really cool. So I was, whoa. And so afterwards, I started to contemplate, investigate, what happened there? And it was very obvious to me after a while that your brain and its six senses even, your brain is only wired to notice things which change. If I'm calm and just watch even the bricks in front of me, with my eyes open, after a while they will disappear. Nothing's going on. The best simile today, which I didn't have that time, your computer screen, if you don't click anything, the computer screen goes into its default mode. It turns off. Nothing's happening. Your brain is the same. Can you hear the hum of the air? Or is it the aircon? Don't know if the aircon, even if the aircon was on, after a while you can't hear it. Maybe the hum of the lighting, I don't know. Can you actually feel the heat or the cold on your body? Can you feel it now? After a while you won't notice that heat in your body, simply because it's not changing. The sound of traffic in the distance, after a while you can't hear it. And the most obvious one is the saliva in your throat. Now it's a problem. But it's the same feeling after a while, because it won't change, you don't feel it anymore. Close your eyes, I see the inside of my eyelids. Sight hasn't turned off yet, but give it a few seconds. And it's not as if you're seeing nothing, it's you're not seeing. Sense of sight turns off. All your five senses, they will only be activated if there's a movement. If there's no movement, if it is still, then it turns off. That is an important key to understanding meditation. To turn off the five senses, you have to get stillness first of all. And then the switch is flicked naturally and it's turned off. So there I was watching a whitewashed wall, nothing was moving. I was just, my mind was still enough just to be watching it. I wasn't fantasizing and distracting myself, because nothing was moving, it turned off. When you do open this lotus flower, the body, the only thing left is sitting still, nothing is really happening to it, your body awareness turns off. Smell, taste turns off. Hearing turns off. And the only thing left which is still moving, my breath. It's natural. I also should have got this years ago with that anecdote when Ajahn Chakwa, my predecessor, went into a flotation chamber. I was supposed to go in there next. But you know what happened? We were scammed. The person who had this flotation chamber invited Ajahn Chakwa, please, the first flotation chamber, the sensory deprivation chamber in Perth, please, I invite you to try it out for free. So being senior, he got in there first. And that he described it to me. It was just warm water, your body temperature. You didn't feel any heat and cold. It was salty, so you floated in it. There was no pressure on your body at all. Your body was relaxed, no tightness on it at all. Not like the tightness in your bum or, you know, tightness in your legs or anything. It was room temperature. They had some sort of air supply there, obviously, but there was no sort of sound of the air coming in or going out. It was soundproof. And I thought, wow, and it's lightproof because there was, you know, no light coming in there. So I thought, this was great. What a wonderful place to meditate. It's like being in a cave, but a cave, you know, floating in this beautiful, warm, saline water. So your body sort of temperature, your body's density. So you just floated. I thought, wow, it'd be great for meditation. But then what happened the next day, that morning, I had a big advertisement in the back of the West Australian. Flotation chambers, as used by Buddhist monks. To help them. we were conned. And, you know, then so they could put us in the advert. And so, well, you know, the damage has already been done. Can I still go there? Because I was really looking forward to it. No. Can't. Oh, that's really mean. But anyway, so, well, did he enter deep meditation there because everything was conducive to you? And he said, no, you wouldn't believe just when all those other senses had been turned off that the breath was so loud. Because the usual breath, it's just dampened by all the other noise of the world. But when sort of all that other noise is taken out, you don't realize just how strong the sound of your breath is. And I thought, that's really interesting, because that's one of the reasons why you take your breath, it happens naturally, and the next stage of the meditation, you start calming the breath down. So that becomes nice and smooth. So as you open up the lotus, you get to the breath, the rest of the body is just, you know, looking after itself, you can't feel it, nice and peaceful. And to notice how lovely that is, the story of the mosquitoes in Thailand, oh, there were so many mosquitoes in Thailand. And I don't know why Sir Ajahn Chah did this. I mean, it's okay, it worked for me, but I'm sure it drove a few other monks insane. That, what Nana Chart, I was one of the first six monks who went there, and when I went there, there was not one building in the place, it was just a forest. It was a charnel ground with ghosts, real ghosts in that charnel ground. That's the village used to come there to do the cremations in the village. And so we were staying over there. We eventually started building some huts, but it took a while. So every evening, Ajahn Chah, now just to get people's interest, he would come there and we'd meditate for 2 hours and then he would give a little talk afterwards. But when he came, it was always at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. 2 hour meditation. 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. in the jungles. And it was real jungles. You know, it wasn't sort of, you know, fake jungles like these days. Every time I tell my monks, when I was a young monk, they go, oh no, here he goes again. When I was a young monk story. But it was just pretty primitive. And so we'd come there and 6 o'clock was when the mosquitoes came out. The jungle, swarms of them. That was their feeding time in the evening, twilight. And of course, you know, look at how we dress. Just so many seats at the dinner table. No hair. Look, you know, they can't get into your head. Maybe you've got a little bit of exposed area. For monks, there's so many places they can get to. And there was no mosquito repellent, no mosquito coils, no mosquito nets, nothing. It was just a free-for-all for the mosquitoes. And also, that it was a fact, I'm not exaggerating, that some of us were the first Westerners ever in that part of Thailand. And this happened when I went to one village. They'd never seen a Westerner before, ever, let alone a Western monk. And it was the custom there, whenever you put food in the monk's bowl, you were taught by your mother, your grandma, not to look in the monk's eyes. You just focus on the bowl. Not here. They'd never seen a Western monk before. So they had their eyes staring at me, their mouths open. And the piece of sticky rice just fell outside the bowl. So I didn't get much alms food because I kept missing the bowl all the time. But anyway, so it's the same with the mosquitoes, the first Western food they'd ever had. A delicacy. So they were swarming on us. Really, I didn't know why, but we would always get, the white Western monks would always get the majority of mosquitoes. There's all sorts of theories afterwards, like our blood vessels were closer to the surface of our skin or something because we came from a different climate. But we certainly got smothered with mosquitoes. And afterwards, you look to the Thai monks, they just hardly had any mosquito bites at all, and we had the heaps of them. So once I was with one of my friends, we were doing the game of counting how many mosquitoes we had on our arm. Stupid Westerners, to see who got the most. And you could get, and again, this is not one of those exaggeration stories, 60 or 70 at one time. And then you couldn't sort of distinguish them because they're too close together. You couldn't resolve, you know, two mosquitoes are too close. Feeding frenzy. Fortunately, there was no malaria in that part of Thailand at the time. But you can imagine how irritating that was, almost unendurable. And sometimes you'd open your eyes and you'd see Ajahn Chah sitting there so peacefully. If he wasn't there, I'd have run away. It was my pride kept me there. But then you just can't, endurance wasn't enough. So eventually you just decide to go inside, watch your breathing. And go, so the body just disappeared, vanished. So because you were still, you weren't worried. After a while, the body vanished. Yay! That's the way I cope with mosquitoes. When Ajahn Chah used to call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito, Teacher Mosquito, yeah, I think that he had a point there. They taught me just how to let go of the body and just allow it to be still, not worry about it, until it vanished. Stillness is the cause for vanishing, disappearing. So you do that with your body, and then after a while the body just vanishes. And then you just got your breath. And that's hard to get that to vanish. But what you do is, because you're reasonably still, a natural process kicks in. You're not needing so much oxygen. You're sitting there perfectly, you're not thinking. Remember that your brain, I thought it was about 30%, but recently I read about 20%, but that degree of energy your brain consumes. So imagine just, not just the, this is one of my excuses for putting on weight, because I don't eat that much, but my brain is so calm and quiet, I don't use much. If I could only worry some more, and think more, and contemplate more, then of course it'll all be used up. So my metabolism as a monk goes way down, because you don't waste so much energy in your brain worrying. 20 to 30% of the energy you consume is wasted by your brain. Imagine when that energy is not used. It's free. So because you're not using that energy, you don't need the oxygen to metabolize it. So your brain naturally, your breath naturally gets very soft and very light. You don't need much breath. So peaceful, breathing in, breathing out. Hardly discernible, but joyful. Anything which is soft and peaceful is joyful. Oh, yeah. Now, it is always joyful, but the problem is many of us have been taught, oh, if you get any joy in meditation, you'll get attached. And so even happiness, joy, is considered to be like an evil part of religion. Someone once gave me a definition of the Puritan strain of Christianity, the most austere and ascetic part of Christianity, which was, they describe Puritanism as the fear that someone, somewhere, is being happy. Wipe that smile off your face. When I did go to Hong Kong, the first time I went to Hong Kong, there was a very lovely nun there, a Mahayana nun, quite old, and she came up to me after, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, Ajahn Brown. So, oh, did I teach you some nice Dhamma? You get sort of a good meditation, get nice. And no, it wasn't for that. He said, thank you for now giving us all permission to smile as Buddhist nuns. Because they said, before you came, if I smiled or even laughed, that was even worse. They'd think I was a bad nun. And that's how sort of tough it was. You know, you're supposed to be serious. You're supposed to be experiencing suffering. Come on, dukkha. Wow. And you're happy, there's something wrong there. That can't be the practice. Of course, that's a lot of old gomayang, because even the Buddha smiled, the monks smiled, because there's wonderful stories there. And there's also the, you know, from the suttas. And there's also that once she was allowed to smile, she was suppressing it. Sort of her practice took off. And of course, people like coming to monasteries where people smile. For me, I would never go and study under a miserable monk. If that monk was miserable, then obviously he was still suffering himself, hadn't got past it. So anyway, that once you accept happiness as part of the path, then of course, beautiful breath, breathing in, breathing out. And I have to do part two of this because it's almost getting to 9 o'clock. But good old Ajahn Gunha, who, you know, he spent a range retreat here many years ago, and I see him really often these days, and every time that he would teach, even the last time I was in Korea, he was supposed to teach there. I recommended him because they wanted, I knew a few people in the Jogchi order in Korea. Can you get sort of a nice meditation master from Thailand? I said straight away, Ajahn Gunha. I never thought he would go there, but he went there to Korea a couple of times. And the last time I was there, just like last September, October, so he was supposed to give a talk. You know what he does? He said, oh, Ajahn Brown, you give the talk for me because you know what I say. So I had to give the talk for him. But anyway, when he was here, you know, you ask him about the Dhamma, how to meditate, meditation instructions. You know what he used to say for his meditation instructions? It comes from the word like sabai. Sabai means nice and easy, comfortable, beautiful, delightful. And he would say, breathe in. Sabha. Breathe out. Sabha. And that was it. That was his meditation instructions. My goodness, they were really clear and very effective. Not if you wanted to write a book about it, or you wanted to think a lot about it, but just when you get to that stage, you're breathing in, just nice and beautiful. Oh, yeah. Oh, breathing in. Oh, yeah, I can do this all afternoon. Oh. Breathing out, Sabah. Notice meditation. And there was a lot of wisdom and skillful means in that. So, if you get stuck this afternoon, try the Ajahn Ganha method. I don't know what Sabah is in Sinhala. What's the word Sabah? It's really nice and easy. What is nice? I don't know what word it will be in Sinhala, or what word it will be sort of in, even in Australian, what would it be? I like the word sabai because I grew up on that word, sabai. What?
Sublime.
Sublime, oh, not bad. Breathe in, sublime. Breathe out, sublime. Oh, yeah. You get into it. Don't be afraid of the happiness. And then you do find it's easy to be with the breath. Because it's accompanied by happiness. Your mind is fulfilled and satisfied with the joy of peace. You're just watching your breath. You're inside the lotus. And if you get to the stage of the delightful breath, sabai, you'll find you can meditate for hours. Just that much. But be warned. Sometimes you get into the sabai, sabai breath. And it gets to lunchtime. And this is your last meal, you're not going to eat later on. And it sometimes is a bit of a dilemma. Should I get up to eat lunch or should I sabai? And if it really is the delightful breath, lunch has got no chance. You just stay with the delightful breath. Oh, this is nice. That's how delightful it is. You can have lunch any time or dinner. All your life you can do things like that, but to get a nice, peaceful, joyful breath, wow, that's really cool. And it doesn't finish. Like lunch, after it finishes, it turns into, well, not Go Mayang, the human Mayang. But the beautiful breath, that turns into something amazing. Energy, good health, and really powerful insights. That's really worth it. So anyway, my time is up. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So have fun with the sabai breath.